Welcome, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for the Limar Technical Net. Limar Technical Net has been going on since 1982. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m. here on W2BL and the Sun Tree repeaters at Echo 2. And as always, I like to start the technical net with a little information on my part. If you cannot contact us using the radio or Echo Link or IRLT or what have you, we have an email address. If you have any questions or if you have any topics of interest or if you would like to share puzzles, we like to offer puzzles to the participants out there to play around with. Or if you want me to tap Paul, WS2N, on the shoulder about something NASA space-related, have to take a look at it and give his opinion. The email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at, my call sign is alpha charlie 2 gulf sierra.com. We have a link page of a whole bunch of interesting articles. There are some links that are more visual that we can't really go into in the radio. And Paul has some images he likes to share often. And I have a whole bunch of interesting links if I get to them for the science talk. And if I don't, you can read them on your own. Because the links are all available on my link page, which you can reach by just typing into your web browser, roy.ac2gs.com. And as I've mentioned before, we do have a chat room. You can either go to Limar's own website and look for the link to the chat room, or you can just type into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. We have a live stream of W2BL via me, 24/7, so if you are not close to a radio and you would like to listen in to the repeater action, I try to make that available throughout the week. You just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the live feed for the W2BL repeater. And as always, I like to remind everyone that MikeAC2NJI has a great archive site of technical nets that go all the way back to September of 2006. His website is called amateurradio.tv. So keep that in mind as well. There's a lot of wisdom from Silent Keys who have passed on. So please keep that all in mind. I will drop and I will tell you what plans are for tonight's little episode. Okay, as the tradition with the technical net, we will start by asking people if they have questions of the technical nature, and we will take down their first name and their call sign, and we'll try and get to them in order. Around 8:30 or so, 8:30 to 8:45, we will summon the spirit of Andy, WA2CDL, for Andy's Corner. He has another great presentation for us tonight. And when he's done with the Andy's Corner, I will return and finish up the questions and ask if anyone has any further questions and maybe offer a puzzle or two. And if time is available, we can get into some interesting science talk articles that I've read this past week. We can discuss those as well. Around 10:15 or so, we will call upon Paul, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report. He will take us all the way to 11 p.m., where I will return and tie a bow on it, wish you all well, and call it a night. So that's the plan. I hope the repeater is reasonable tonight and we can actually do all these things. I hope that people out there are in an active participating mood for some interesting questions and answers tonight. So with that in mind, I will drop for a second and ask for people to tell me if they would have any questions tonight. Give me your first name and your call sign.
November 2, Zulu Charlie, John.
Okay, you can use Echo Link. It's a little waffly with the delays and such. You know, as long as no one's keying up in front of you, shouldn't be a problem. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight for any questions of a technical nature, please?
Bravo. John, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
I got November 2, Zulu Charlie. Is that the entire call sign?
That's the call sign. Handle is John.
Okay, John, you're on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight for any questions? Give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, I could just make out that you have a quick question, but you're about 90% noise. I could just barely make out the voice behind you. So if you're on a handy talkie or something with a movable antenna, see if we can get a better signal out of you. Okay, I made out that you said that you don't think this is going to work. So I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, if the propagation conditions change or antennas change or, transmitter output changes, please feel free. You know where to find us. Anyone else want to check in and with a question or a comment tonight of a technical nature? I give you your first name and your call sign. Okay, we will take the first question up. I see Craig has linked into EchoLink, and I hope it works well for him. So, Craig, what?
Heard a station in there checking in.
Okay, Paul, if there's a station out there, please try again. We have an interesting cross-connection, so sometimes I don't quite hear things that other people hear. So try one more time. Give us your first name and your call sign.
This is Jim, KD2VHD, Mobile.
Okay, Jim recognized, you're on the list for tonight. Getting back to the first person, Craig, on EchoLink, we'll drop the repeater for a little while because it takes a little bit longer to capture it using EchoLink. What's your question tonight, Craig?
Yeah, I'm going to use my phone because I don't know if my V82 has got enough power for tonight and I don't feel like struggling. So it has to do with my Jeep that I have, 2015 Cherokee, and I'm approaching 70,000 miles and it's a field unit, but I kind of want to make the thing last a long time, but you would have to go to the dealer to get work done. What are your thoughts on replacing the fluid in a field transmission? Is that possible?
Well, this is not exactly my expertise. I basically just hand the car over to the mechanic and such. But if anyone else out there has any thoughts on it, I would think since it's a sealed device, it's probably not really designed for easy access, drainage, and replacement. But if there's anyone else out there with any opinions or experiences on this subject, please feel free.
A2GJE, does it have a pad that can be dropped?
Ed, I don't know if Craig heard you well. You're about 50% noise. Is there any way you could wiggle the antenna or raise the gain a little bit on the output?
Okay, I'm trying the Eastern Link. How's this, over?
Much, much better, Ed.
question was, does the transmission have a pan that can be dropped over?
Okay, I will ask Frank. My assumption is if it's sealed, it probably doesn't,
right, yeah.
but I could be totally wrong.
That might be the only way to
so, Frank, I see
you
trying
to want to do it because
you
I want to make
understand
this thing
that
last
when
a while,
anyone else transmits,
considering that at 100,000, I'd probably work
anyone.
On the coolant. But
so I will
you know these people out there that say
you can
do it a lifetime, you never need to change it. Well, if you're going to keep your car a long time, then that's a load of nonsense. It still has to be changed.
Okay, Craig, you have to understand that if you operate through EchoLink, if you double, no one will hear you. And I was talking while you were talking, so no one heard you. So there's still Ed's question. Is there a drop-down pan involved in that car of yours?
Judging by the looks of his desk, there should be a pan underneath. But the only way to have that done, I think, is through the dealer, though.
And to HOH.
Yes, Andy.
Good evening, Roy, in the TechNet. I don't have a new car. I have a 24-year-old Ford Explorer. I have a pan to change my transmission fluid, but I don't use that method. And it only holds about 4 quarts, yet the system holds about 8 to 10 quarts of fluid. So the way I change my fluid, which is a 90% flush, is I disconnect the transmission cooler line to a hose, to a bucket, and then I keep adding transmission fluid until it comes out bright red and clean, and then I stop and reconnect the line to the transmission cooler, and I just completed my transmission flush. Done that three times, well, about two or three times. And when I bought the truck, and once or twice after that, the past 40,000 miles. And this truck is 24 years old, well over 100,000 miles, and it still runs great. Into HOH.
Okay, thanks a lot, Andy. I'm a little bit confused by the concept of a sealed transmission fluid. So my sensibility would be that this would be a term used if it was not designed for easy access among weekend mechanics and so. Do you know anything particularly about the concept of sealed transmission fluid system?
No, I do not. I've always had American trucks or cars, and whether it's sealed or not, my method would, if it has a transmission cooler line to cool the fluid, it would work. So there's no other method necessary, and it's the only method I use for my own vehicles. And I have a pan, and I don't use that method because it doesn't yield a full flush. Like I said, it only the pan only holds about 25 to 40% of capacity of the transmission fluid. The rest of it's in a converter. But I'm not familiar at all with any other transmissions, in all honesty. But if the condition of the fluid warrants changing, that's the way I would change it. Again, Handy Andy N2HOH.
A2GJE. Wrong in changing the fluid. However, inside that transmission, when you drop the pan, there's a filter. And some problems that people have are only because of a clogged filter. It's very easy to drop that pan, it really is. Yes, it doesn't hold much fluid, but inside that pan is a very easy changeable filter. I've done it many times on many vehicles, over.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Flushing system is what most of the mechanics will do to bring it in, but the sealed transmission, that's if he goes to look for a dipstick to check, he's not going to find one. If you're going to go look for a place to add transmission fluid, you're not going to find one. That's what really what they mean by a sealed system. But, you know, they're good for, they say they're good for over 100,000 miles. So I don't know. I'd give it another 30,000 before I'd start worried about it. I don't know. I worked with a mechanic for many years. He was in his previous life, he was an auto mechanic. And he pretty much was a believer in not even changing transmission fluids. Yeah, if you can get to the filters now and then, that's good. But, you know, even 20, 30, 40 years ago, he says, the fluids were just terrific, you know, unless you had a problem with your transmission. And then of course, you know, that's another story. And if you have a problem with your transmission, they're going to change, you know, when they take it apart, that's the fluid.
Yeah, AHU first, then 2IV.
Yeah, KB2HHU, SIG, North Baltimore. I didn't get the whole question, but they were talking about changing transmission fluid. Just so you know, for example, my wife has a Volvo, a late model Volvo, which does not have a dipstick and, you know, et cetera. But there, if you do searches on the internet, I don't know if the gentleman did this, you know, there's all these user groups that show how people have been able to change the fluid in, you know, these places that normally users don't, you know, people don't do, like transmission or the transfer case or the rear differential, et cetera, which usually they say is sealed, but there is usually some kind of drain access and fill access, or you may have to suck it out with a vacuum pump, et cetera, all kinds of things which do work, and I have done this in my wife's car, so, you know, maybe that's an answer. And the other thing with the filters, a lot of transmissions that I've seen, at least some, you know, with like Hondas and the Chevy I have, has a internal filter that you can't easily replace anymore. You have to basically tear the transmission down to replace it. So, you know, the filter is not as easy as it used to be. I know what he's talking about with the pan, it's a cake, but some of these newer transmissions, the filter's internal, and, you know, to change it, you can't unless you take the whole thing apart. KB2HHU.
Okay, thanks a lot. 2IB, I think that was a W2IB. You had a comment as well?
AA2IT.
Oh, okay, Tony.
AA2IT.
Yeah, Joe, I see you on Echolink, AA2IT. Did you want to say something to us?
Yes. This is Joe, AA2IT. The transmissions are sealed because the transmissions are so high-tech and precision that the manufacturer only wants you to use the fluid that they specified, and you can damage your transmission if you change it out and just go to the auto parts store and buy your choice of transmission fluid. So that's the reason they seal it up, and if you want to change it, you should just call the dealer up. That would be the best thing to do.
Okay, thank you very much, Joe. That makes a great deal of sense. You know, I mean, when we were young, automobiles were not as complicated as they are now today. They have computers and all manner of things that if you change them a little bit, that they go wonky on you. A good sense of what the answers are. It sounds like
If you're a cautious person, you'll contact the dealer and find the proper transmission fluid, and then you can decide whether you want to do it yourself or have someone do it for you.
It's pretty much possible, but it's also presumed that my transmission is a continuous variable, CVT. And so, yeah, they seal them because people were putting the wrong stuff in there and damaging them, and so you have to go to the dealer to get work done on it. Each individual transmission has its own steps. Some of them have, like, 3 to 4 pages of directions of what you have to do. Like, you have to jack the car up, you got to put it in neutral for 5 seconds, hold it at this, put it in drive, put it in neutral, put it back in drive, put it in reverse. You got to do, like, all those things to, like, just to change it. It's very complicated.
Enzo HOH.
Yes, Andy.
Thanks, Roy. I just wanted to ask Craig if he has a Kia. What vehicle does he have, and how does he like the CVT transmission? Which I test drove a Kia with a CVT, and I kind of liked it, but then it was a brand new car, so I'm driving a 24-year-old truck, so it's not a fair evaluation. But I just wanted to know how he liked that CVT transmission.
It's okay for the most part. I have a 2015 Cherokee from Jeep. It's a Chrysler.
No, I would have never guessed they had that style of transmission in there. Okay, very good. I enjoyed my test drive, and good luck with that. Again, just wanted to finalize that. Even if there's no fill tube or otherwise or dipstick, my method for changing the transmission fluid isn't. It's got a cooling line. You can take fluid out and add fluid in with both the input output of the cooling line. So I do maintain that that's a good way of doing it, at least for my my 30-some-odd years of experience. But then again, I don't have a new vehicle. My truck is from 1998. Again, back to that N2HH. KD2BR,
Roger, Nipple.
Yes, Jim.
I believe that Jeep was a his Grand Cherokee he was talking about, and that was one under Daimler Chrysler, the German design vehicle, and as such, everything's a little more complicated than it needs to be.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Jim. And well, I don't know, Greg. I think the general consensus is it's complicated, and unless you don't have the scratch, you probably best to let them handle it for you, unless you like puzzles and such. But this one sounds like it's a combination transmission fluid change and puzzle.
Yeah, I'd expect the dealer is the only way to do it, because like I said before, these newer transmissions, they have like so many instructions on how to do it. Like I told you before, you have to jack the car up and you got to put it in reverse, drive, and neutral and do this a bunch of times. It's super complicated, but yeah, that's why they make it so that you have to go to the dealer to get work done on it.
Okay, I mean, I wish we had a simpler, less expensive answer for you tonight. But people are not designing things to be easily fixed anymore. It's a little bit better than consumer goods, where they actually glue components together. At least I haven't heard anyone gluing anything together in cars yet. So it's just not user-friendly, shall we say. So I'm sorry that it's going to cost you money to do it, but that's the way it sounds, unless you're very intrepid about taking chances and risks with your car. So I thank you for your question tonight.
Nah, I should be good. I'm going to go east. Thank you, Roy. APPGS, KD2LGD.
Okay, very good. John, do you mind if we hold off with your question a little while? Because this is around the time that Andy likes to do his corner, but I just want to make sure it's okay with you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you for the courtesy of Andy. That, absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much, John. So, it's 8:26, which is now it's 8:27, time flies. Anyway, I'm looking forward to another episode of Andy, WA2CDL's Andy's Corner. So, Andy, if you're out there somewhere, get into your corner, get nice and comfy, and do your thing.
All right, Roy, I got to squeeze myself in. Good evening, everyone. This is WA2CDL, and you're listening to Andy's Corner. You're going to be listening to Andy's Corner. And this is like a last-minute thing. I've been sort of busy with distractions and really haven't had much time to go through all the millions of articles and paperwork and books that I have to start reading about different things in relation to the hobby. So I came across one article which I think people would appreciate because it has to do with antennas, and we're all using an antenna of some type, or at some times also. And this particular article that I came across, and it was a spur of the moment, it's relating to beam antennas. And most people, I would think, know what a beam antenna is as opposed to a omnidirectional antenna. Now, there's many different beam antennas for different frequencies and different lengths and elements and sizes and shapes and so on. But the main advantage of a beam antenna is just like it says, you can beam the signal in a certain direction. You put your antenna on a rotator, I think they call it a rotor, and you turn the antenna and you can direct the signal in any way you want to direct it to, in a 360-degree pattern. Alright, so that's a beam antenna, and depending on the number of elements and the spacing between the elements and so on, will determine the gain, the directivity, the beam width, front to back ratio, and all the different aspects of it that you probably, some of the terms you've probably heard. So this little article is about beam antennas, or what they call it a parasitic array. And if anyone has seen how a beam antenna is constructed, they'd be interested to know there is no direct connection between the driven element, and the driven element is what the coax connector is connected to, your coax cable, to a matching network, which will be discussed at some time. And then you have what is called a director and a reflector. And the reflector is usually behind the driven element, and the director is usually in front of the driven element. You know, the driven element, again, being the one that actually has the coax cable to your rig through the coax cable to the antenna, and that's how the connection is made. So because there's no direct connection from one element to another, they call it a parasitic array. And so they'll go into this little discussion of what is a parasitic array, and then we'll talk a little bit about directors and reflectors and so on. So I just thought this would be interesting because a lot of you guys out there do have a beam antenna of some type. So I found this article, and maybe we'll just continue this discussion because from the previous discussions on antennas we were talking about, that we're going to go into broadcast antennas, higher power antennas and so on. Right? So a little bit out of the league to talk about a broadcast type of antenna, and there's many, many different types. There's turnstile antennas, and there's helical antennas. Not necessarily for broadcasting, but for other types of communications, and so on. So, anyway, parasitic arrays, or beam antennas, that's what we're talking about. Okay, there's also circularly polarized, which is the word I was thinking of, which gives a multiple patterns. You could, in regard to the beam antennas, you could mount it horizontally or vertically, or at an angle. You could mount it 45 degrees. I think Dick was talking about his end. I think he had a beam antenna. It was actually not really horizontal, not really vertical. It was situated at some angle. He would have both patterns at the same time. So, you know, because as your signal travels through space, it does rotate. What do they call that? Faraday rotation? I've heard that word. So you could have a vertically polarized signal leave, but by the time it comes to the receiver end, it could be horizontally polarized, or a combination of both, because of reflection, refraction, absorption, and everything else that's due to the signal. Rather complex. All right, so getting into this, parasitic arrays. A parasitic element has a direct DC connection to the driven element of an antenna. It is placed close to the driven element, which causes a current to be induced in the parasitic element by the field of the driven element. The parasitic element then becomes a radiator and re-radiates the induced energy. This re-radiated field combines with the radiation from the driven element to establish the directivity characteristics of the antenna. The vertical and horizontal radiation patterns, the antenna gain, and the terminal impedance are determined by the phase relationship between the field of the driven element and the re-radiated field of the parasitic element. The phase of the current induced in the parasitic element with relation to the current in the driven element is determined by the spacing between the elements. The length, which determines the resonance frequency of the parasitic element, and the position of the parasitic element. So, you have some mechanics involved as far as the spacing, the length, and so on. So beams are pretty complicated. When you build a beam antenna, there's a lot of physical dimensions you have to consider. You know, along with the antenna being resonant to the frequency that you want to use it on, of course. And then, of course, you got matching. You'll have to match the impedances of your feed line, whatever the feed line impedance is, to the antenna, because when you match impedances, you get your maximum power transfer. Okay, so we've been talking about this driven element. And let's see. Just reading a little bit ahead here just to make sure there's nothing that I could it'd be hard to explain. So like any two coupled resonant circuits, each element influences the loading and characteristics of the other. Okay, so if you study resonant circuits and coupled circuits, you will understand that there is a reflected or mutual impedance that determines the loading of the tuned circuit for which energy is being driven, or drawn in this case. The reflected load changes the impedance of the tuned circuit to some value other than the unloaded radiation resistance. So the point is, you know, that the reflected load, because of the element spacing, determines the actual impedance of the driven element itself. So again, you know, when you build a beam antenna, you have to make sure that the physical dimensions are determined so you have the proper matching and you have the proper gain and so on that you're trying to accomplish. Okay, so parasitic elements, and again, I'm just reiterating what I said before, it's not directly connected to the driven element, and that's what's known as a parasitic element, can be dimensioned, spaced, and tuned to act as either as reflectors or directors. And there's actually a figure that shows that. You can have a director, reflector, or you can have both. When the parasitic element is placed between the driven element and the direction of maximum radiation, it is called the director. And I mentioned that before earlier. If the parasitic element is placed behind the driven element, and the driven element itself is placed between the parasitic and the direction of maximum radiation, the parasitic element is now called the reflector. And they show a picture of it. So, you know, one is behind the driven element, one is in front of the driven element. The way that I've determined which way the antenna is pointing, just for information's sake, you know, if somebody says here's a beam antenna on a tower, you know, which way is it facing? All I need to do is look at the longest element length, you know, just by physically looking at it, and I will know which way it's pointing, because in 99.9% of the cases, the reflective element, the reflector, is the longer element of the two or three. So if you have a driven element at a certain length, you have a reflector at a certain length, and you have a director at a certain length, the reflector is always the longest length. So depending on which way the antenna is pointing, you can see that, oh, okay, it's pointing in this direction because here's the reflector. And you'll know that right away. And that's the way that I've always determined which way it's pointing. Just the information. Okay, so whether the parasitic element behaves as a director or as a reflector depends on the spacing of the driven element, in particular, the phase of the current compared to the current in the driven element. This phase relationship is determined by the spacing and the tuning of the parasitic element. Again, we're talking about the spacing between that and the director. Or I should say the driven element. A little bit confusing maybe. Sometimes to explain this, if you have to visualize what I'm talking about. A parasitic element is usually tuned by adjusting its length so that the element itself resonates a little above or below the resonant frequency of the driven element. However, parasitic elements can be tuned by other means. So, Okay, I'm just reading this again just so I can understand it as far as tuning it in the parasitic element is concerned. So if you get an idea of what I'm trying to convey here is that you have, you know, you have a driven element and you have a director on one side, you have a reflector on the other side, and you have to adjust the spacing between the elements, and you have to adjust the length between the length of each element, and so on. So now we're going to talk about the director itself, or directors. The length of the parasitic element, and they, again, they keep referring to it as the parasitic element, you know. Now they're specifying it as a director. So, the length of the parasitic element used as a director is approximately 4% less than the length of the driven element. So that's good to know, too. So your director is going to be shorter always. In 99% of the cases, your director will be shorter than your driven element. And again, like I said before, because I jumped ahead, your reflector will be longer than the driven element. That's how you know which way to point to look at. So because of this, I'm just going to repeat, the length of the parasitic element used as the director is approximately 4% length than, well, 4% less than the length of the driven element. This causes it to resonate at a higher frequency than the driven element, which makes sense because it's shorter in length, and as the length becomes shorter, your resonant frequency goes up. And because of that, therefore, it is slightly capacitive, and because the way capacitors work, current leads the voltage by a certain number of degrees, it has a leading current compared to the current in the driven element. By the way, if it was inductive, it would be a lagging current, because voltage leads the current by a certain number of degrees, and the capacitor, current leads the voltage. So, and they're talking about current here, so one leads, one lags. Okay, that's from your basic capacitive and inductive components, how they work. The factor that has the most influence on the gain and the impedance of the array, by the way, they call it an array, and that's also a term that's used in beams, because they have more than one element. So any radiating antenna that's got more than one element, a vertical antenna is not known as normally as an array. An array is a combination of elements spaced certain distance apart and so on. So they use that word array, by the way. If you've never heard that term before, it's used quite often. So the factor that has the most influence on the gain and the impedance of the array is the spacing between the driven and parasitic elements. And they show a curve here, which is a little bit hard to show, but the dashed curve shows how the gain varies with variations in the spacing when a director is used, and it says notice that we get maximum gain when the spacing is a little bit more than a tenth of a wavelength. So that's just it's a guesstimate, you know, that they're using as a guide. So whatever the wavelength is, if the spacing is a little bit more than a tenth of that, that's the maximum gain according to this chart. I don't expect everybody to go out and start building beam antennas, but it is a fun project and something that you definitely learn about. The antenna handbook, which I have here in front of me also, goes into all this, but it gets a little bit mathematical. and a lot of diagrams and formulas, and it's, you know, of course, that's hard to convey over the air, so I'm trying to simplify it by just talking about it. All right, continuing. The front-to-back ratio, you know, which is another thing I mentioned, aspect of the antennas, beam antennas called front-to-back ratio. And, you know, that means how much of a rejection you're going to get if you turn the antenna from point A to point B. So the front-to-back ratio of an antenna system is an indication of how much more energy is directed forward than it is radiated off the back of the antenna. Yeah, if you look at the radiation pattern of a beam antenna, it does have lobes, and that's what they call it on a graph. And you have major lobes, and you have minor lobes, and there's certain lobes spacing between them. And that also determines how well-designed the antenna is. I think Dick once mentioned that a properly tuned antenna has a major to minor lobe, a certain attenuation, or in this case, dB. The lobes are actually measured in decibels over a certain distance. And I think 17 dB comes to mind of the first minor lobe in relation to the major lobe of the antenna. When the minor lobe is 17 dB down, you know your antenna is pretty well tuned to the maximum. And that's mathematically figured out. So let's see what they say about this, because I'm not reading it, I'm just talking ahead of myself. So let's see if they actually confirm what I just said. So in this book that I'm reading, so it says the front-to-back ratio of an antenna system is the indication of how much more energy is directed forward than it is radiated off the back of the antenna. This factor is influenced by the length of the parasitic elements. Unfortunately, when the director is spaced and dimensionalized for the best gain, there is a sacrifice made in the front-to-back ratio. Okay, so that's interesting. For example, a director tuned for maximum forward gain with a spacing of 0.1 wavelengths has a front-to-back ratio of approximately 5 decibels, 5 dB. If the director is made slightly shorter than the front-to-back ratio, just to say this again, if the director is made slightly shorter, the front-to-back ratio can be increased to as high as 17 dB with a small sacrifice to the forward gain. Now, it's interesting they mentioned that magic number, 17 dB, because Dick was once talking about the major lobe as opposed to the minor lobe being 17 dB different. And here they talk about that 17 dB came up again. So that's a number to keep in mind, 17 dB. That would be the front-to-back ratio with a small sacrifice at forward gain. So what you want, what you would like to achieve is the higher front-to-back ratio. That's what you really want. Okay, so you got your 70 dB, but your gain fell off slightly. That's due to the spacing of the element. So when a high front-to-back ratio is desired, the slight loss in forward gain is unimportant and need not to be any greater, and that's interesting, it's usually not greater than -1 to -1.5 dB. So, okay, big deal. You sacrificed about, you know, 1 to 1.5 dBs of gain. You got a little bit less gain, but you increased your front to back from 5 dB up to 17 dBs, which is quite a difference. And that's desirable, especially with it for a B-band antenna. So, let's see. Thus, to improve the front-to-back ratio when using a director, the director is generally made slightly shorter than the value indicated for maximum gain. The spacing should be held somewhere in the vicinity of a tenth of a wavelength or slightly less. So again, that's a guide, just to, you know, keep in mind that you, any of you guys out there are going to start building beam antennas, this is a rough guide toward it. Alright, I give you a little curve here that shows you the reflector and director and the element spacing. Actually, this is for antenna resistance in ohms. Oh, let's see what it says about that. The dashed curve that I'm mentioning shows the influence the element spacing has on the antenna's resistance when a director is used. So it mentions, so it says, notice that there's a large reduction in the antenna radiation resistance as compared to a simple dipole, which has, as we spoke in the past, which has a radiation resistance of about 72 ohms, and that's in free space. With a director adjusted to deliver maximum gain at a spacing of a tenth of a wavelength, the antenna's resistance is about 14 ohms. Wow, that's interesting. That really came down a lot, 72 ohms down to 14 ohms. Now that's a pretty low resistance right there. Okay, so the reduction in antenna resistance adds a number of complications to the design and the antenna system. Let's see what they are. Okay, so now we're going to talk about antenna's radiation efficiency. So, let's see. The antenna's radiation efficiency drops because of the higher current, which results in a greater power loss in the antenna. All right, hence, less power is radiated for the lower radiation resistance. In most high-frequency work, the ohmic losses are held to a minimum by using large diameter conductors. Consequently, with half-inch or larger tubing, the heat loss can be considered negligible. So, I guess you could construct it as a beam antenna with a wire, just using an ordinary wire, but your losses, as this is explained, would be much higher, rather than using it, building it out of tubing of some dimension, like half inch or quarter inch or three quarter inch or what have you. Okay, so, because the radiation resistance of the antenna is very low, a suitable matching system must be used so that standard transmission lines can be matched to the impedance of the antenna system. And that makes sense. You're going to have to build a matching device now because you've got such a low impedance. You're going to have to bring it up to 50 ohms or whatever. As a result, the tuning coil... No, let me start over. As a result, the tuning and adjustment of the transmission line system is critical. Selectivity or bandwidth of the antenna system becomes comparatively narrow when parasitic elements are used. To derive full benefits from a parasitic array, the element length and spacing must be adjusted carefully at the desired operating frequency. Okay. By the way, we're concentrating on the directive. That's mainly what the paragraphs are pertaining to. You have a driven element, you have a directive. So you have basically a two-element beam right now. So, for wideband service, it is possible to use modified dipoles having an antenna radiation resistance higher than the conventional half-wave straight dipoles. In addition, compromised dimensions can be used for spacing and element length to cover a wide span of frequencies. However, in any compromised antenna system using parasitic elements, there must be some sacrifice gained below that obtainable when the same antenna is designed for peak performance at a given frequency. So you could, you could play around with different dimensions, different spaces, different lengths, and so on, to achieve whatever you want to achieve. If you you want to experiment, that's a good thing to do. Okay, this is WA2CDL. This is Andy's Corner. And now I'm going just to mention about reflectors. And I think, sorry, I'm on a little bit on a limited schedule tonight. I'll go to work tomorrow. Got another page or so to go. Spoke about directors. Now we're going to go into the reflective part of it. So we're going to change from the director to the reflector. So a reflector is mounted to the rear of the driven element and is about, I said this before, 5% longer than the half-wave element. So as I said earlier, the director is 5% shorter and the reflector is going to be 5% longer. So again, you can just look at the antenna and know which is the reflector, which is the director, and which is the driven element. And now we're talking about a reflector, so we're going to add a reflector to a two-element beam, and we're going to make it a three-element beam. So you're probably figuring it out already. Since it's 5% longer than the half-wave element, the reflector, therefore, is tuned below resonance at a frequency lower than the operating frequency for which the driven element is designed. So it's just the opposite of your director. Your director is tuned above resonance, and your reflector is tuned below resonance. Just for information. See, I'm learning about beam antennas myself here. So at the operating frequency, it functions as an inductance. And remember we said before the director operates as a capacitance. This will operate as an inductance. And has a lagging current. Remember I said before, capacitance has a leading current, inductance has a lagging current, because voltage leads the current. So it has a lagging current as compared to the current in the driven element. And we're referencing, by the way, this is all reference to the driven element. The reflector is reference to the driven element, and the director is reference to the driven element, as far as currents are concerned. Okay. So now it gets a little bit interesting. So now when the re-radiated field from the parasitic element moves into the vicinity of the driven element, these fields now add. And there is a maximum radiation in the forward direction. In the back direction, I don't know why they stated that way, in the back direction, the field of the driven element and the re-radiated reflectors